Let's jump into this. We are moving backwards. We're moving forwards, but we're actually moving backwards. So our subject for today is the beginning of chapter 6. And the reason I call it moving backwards is because we're moving forwards in time. We're now starting the Persian era of Daniel's life, and which will take us through chapter 6. Then we're going to skip 7 and 8 because we already did them. Back chapter 9, 10, 11, 12, the remaining chapters are all under the, all in the context of the Persian arena. We're going backwards, of course, because as I mentioned, we looked at in an earlier shir, the chapters are out of sequence chronologically. So we already studied 7 and 8, which is the very end of Belshazzar, the bridge between Babylon and the Babylonian era and the conquest of Persia against Babel. And so that is where our focus will take us. These sources, both this one, which is the text, chapter 6, of course, is back to Aramaic. So we are back to this text, which you have in the source page link in the chat. And I will also be working off this source page, which you have in the chat link as well. So today we're going to read the parak and see how much of it we can make heads or tails out of, and let's move forward. Pasuk Aleph. I am continuing to read from the Hebrew rather than the Aramaic. V'Dariyavesh Hamadi, Yibela Tamachut Kiven Shanim Shishim Ushtay. Dariyavesh or Darius Hamadi, the Mede. In this contradistinction to Dariyavesh of Persia, who is a successor to Cyrus or Koresh, this Dariyavesh in Tanakh is identified as a Mede king prior to Cyrus, who reigns for 1 year. Whether or not it fits historically with the context of Persian history is a debate of great length, and I'm not going to enter into it, because it will derail our discussion, and this is where the world of the Beis Medrash and the kind of religious or orthodox perspective on Tanakh differs from that of the world of academia. And I'm going to leave this as it is. Dariyavesh Hamadi, Kibel Tamachut, he's the one who succeeds Belshazzar, although he only reigns for 1 year, according to Chazal. And he is 62 years of age. We'll talk about why that is significant when we do the chronology at a later stage. Tovaya lifnei Dariyavesh, v'hikim al hamalchut et ha'achashtar panim me'avyesvim ashayu b'chol hamalchut. Please, Dariyavesh, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, 120 achashtar panim, over the entire kingdom. Why 120? Because at this point in time, the kingdom of Mede, Paras, conquering Babel, consists of 120 different medinot, or different kingdoms, around which we need to have some kind of governing body that is comprised of the entire breadth of Malchut Paras and Madai. Eventually that will grow. How far does it grow and to how many? Anybody know?
127.
Correct. Because that's exactly where you get a sense of the continuity between where we are now and beginning of Megillat Esther, which is also set in the Persian arena, and there it's Sheva Vesim U'Me'ah Medina. Of course, it's written in Hebrew, 127 provinces and 127 different kingdoms, all within that umbrella of Malchut Paras U'Madai. Here we have 120. So you got a sense, a little bit of the continuity. This is just the beginning, but the establishment of this great kingdom. There are some who suggest this as a kind of a quasi-source for the notion of 120 as a number for the Anshe Knesset HaGadola, the men of the Great Assembly. I do not believe that is accurate. I think there's a different source for the 120 members of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola, which has much more to do with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah than this. But nonetheless, it's just an interesting observation. All right, so we have 120 Achashtar Panim who are in control of all of the different kingdoms or countries within the kingdom of Madayu Paras. Ulamala Mehem, on top of these 120, we have another group of three. Sarachin Tlata, some kind of sar or some kind of group that was on top of the Achashtar Panim. Here it's translated as Vizirim. Not quite sure what the translations are, but nonetheless, you have 120 Achashtar Panim, and over them, three chief advisors, three chief governors or satraps, Asher Daniel Echad Mehem, and our Daniel is one of those three. He's reached a very significant pinnacle in the Persian arena, to the point where he's been appointed to one of these top three in the inner council of the king. These satraps would give account, would give an accounting, accountability or report to these three. And that would protect the king. There's a lot of Megillat Esther that echoes in these stories, and it's very helpful for a study of Megillat Esther to have this kind of background. Here you see that in order to protect the king from political fallout, he has a kind of a set of a hierarchy of individuals who are in charge of the daily affairs of the state, and that way it protects the king, much like Ahasuerus, who especially after his assassination attempt, places Haman in charge of the kingdom and kind of isolates himself in his palace. You have the same kind of protection. Azayd Daniel Zehaya Gover al Habzimim va Achashtar Panim Kolomach Ruach Yeterabo. This is a kind of a editorial comment that amongst the three, Daniel distinguished himself above all of the others because Ruach Yeterabo, he had this extra spirit in him, Ruach Chochmah, Ruach Elokim, quasi prophecy. Daniel was unique. And so it was recognized. Ve'hamelech chashav lahakimo al kol hamachut, to the point that the king even considered setting him up as the chief, much like Haman was to Achashverosh, kind of one over all the others. Daryavesh had maybe even considered placing Daniel in that role. So already we see how significant Daniel plays in this kingdom. He's reached really almost the pinnacle of political accomplishment, much like Yosef was appointed as the viceroy in Egypt. Daniel, the king, is considering in a position even above the three that we have that are above the other 120 in this hierarchy of Malchut Madayu Paras. It's just an interesting note. How did Daniel get to this kind of significant stature and position? Either just by his own wisdom and efforts. It's also possible, if you remember, when we looked at the world of Belshazzar and the prophecies of Belshazzar, at the time that the writing on the wall took place in year 3, where was Daniel? He was in Shushan, he was in Elam, he was already in Persia, meaning he had left Babel, he had gone over to the side of Persia, and it's quite possible that because of this insight, he knew that Persia on the rise against Babel is going to fall, and he was already there, kind of recognized for his efforts. And so Daniel has a very deep relationship with the king of Persia. Azai havzirim v'achashtar panim hayu mevakshim alila limtzol Daniel mitzad hamachut. But of course, that was too good to last. And the vizirim and the achashtar panim, the presidents and the satraps and the whatever they're called, they sought to find some kind of pretense in order to bring Daniel down. The jealousy was too much. They could not handle this Daniel being so successful. And they sought to find some fault in him, some misdeed, some misdoing, some crime that he might have committed that they could bring him down. they have made it their business to set their sights against Daniel. But to spite their efforts, they could not find any fault with Daniel. No corruption scandals, no sexual scandals, no personal scandals, no government scandals, no bribes, nothing. Daniel was just, as they call it in the world of politics, squeaky clean. Kolomach and Emmanuel, he was loyal. V'chol mishigeu moshchat lo nimtzatzlo. They could not find any error or fault in him. And so, in the absence of any fault that they could find, they had no choice but to make something up. And that will take us into the second part of the text. Azai ha'anashim e'ele omrim, shelo nimtza lo Daniel zekol alila, ele imatzanu etzlo bidat Elohav. We're going to have no choice. We're going to have to find some kind of fault against him. If they can't find it in terms of corruption in his operations, then at least let's find it in the context of his religion, in his loyalty to his God. And that sets up the stage for the next part of the parak. So I just want to take a step back for 1 second and recognize the fact that this context here introduces us to a very new kind of, actually, I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see you all. This conversation takes us into a very different kind of hatred towards Daniel by as an individual, and broader speaking, the Jews as a people. And it sets Persia apart from precedents from nations that came before it and those who will come after it. In other words, if we look at the arc of Tanakh, it's a fascinating observation. This is written up in Rav Medan Sefer on Daniel as well. Fascinating observation about the nature of the various empires and the relationship with Israel, even those who were our enemies. So, for example, let's take Babel as a case example, because Babel was our primary kind of nemesis, if you will, for the last number of years. Babel's conflict with Israel was very clearly one that was both national and political, meaning it was a territorial conquest. They were conquering the world, and various kings, empires were in conflict with each other, and kings of Israel sided one way or the other. Tzidkiyahu sided with Paro, etc. There was a conflict of who was loyal to whom. And so their issue wasn't necessarily a animosity towards the Jew per Jew, but rather towards the Jewish the nation of Israel or the nation of Judah, because they were a political entity that was quote unquote in their way of their political aspirations. The flip side of the coin is Greece, Yavan, which will come much later, post-Tanakh, but Daniel references it in many of his chapters. And the conflict with Greece, as we already saw in the previous discussion of the Nevuah of regarding Antiochus, was very much one of a religious nature, meaning Antiochus set himself up as a decrees specifically targeting the religious nature of Judaism because it was a matter of a cultural assimilation into Greece or not, right? That was the main focus of Daniel's attitude towards understanding of Greece, was that this king that would arise would go to war with the heavens. Persia is very different. The enemies of Persia, the enemies of the Jewish people that come from Persia in Tanakh, whether they be the satraps here in the context of Daniel, or they be Haman in the context of Ahasuerus, their attitude, their hatred, their animosity, and their malevolence is specifically targeted at the fact that this particular individual or group of individuals are Jews. It's the first real instance of what we today identify as classic anti-Semitism that you have in the context of Tanakh. Tanakh is not an arena in which anti-Semitism usually is a factor, because all of the conflicts are political and or religious in nature. But anti-Semitism in terms of hatred of the Jew per Jew And just for that reason, that's really unique to the stamp of Persia. You have it in Haman, and now you have it in the precursor to Haman, which of course are the satraps who set themselves up against Daniel. So let's go back to this story. Of course, you can ask the question why that is the case. I suspect to a large degree, Israel at this point in time doesn't really pose any kind of political threat. They've been in exile for a long time. They're certainly not a religious threat in any way. But I think that you sort of have this sense that they are, they're just there. And Persia is becoming, in this regard, less tolerant of them. And so you have this conflict set up. Okay, let's go back to Pasuk Zion. So these presidents and satraps, they came, and prefects, whatever they are, they came to the king, and they offered the following. King Darius, live forever. Classic greeting to the king. All of the presidents of the kingdom have gathered together and have come to a conclusion. All of the various levels, governors and ministers and satraps, etc. Lakim kiyum hamelech, in order to strengthen the position of the king, velatet tokef leisar, and to give stability and credence to his position. Shekol asher yivakesh bakasha mikol Eloa ve'adam, that anybody who seeks petition, who has a request of any man or deity, yivakesh bakasha mikol Eloa ve'adam ad yamim 30 for 30 days, chutz mimecha hamelach, if it not be directly of you, Mike, our king, yoshlach legov arayot, shall be thrown into the den of lions. Meaning, the context here is a decree. And this decree, which we'll see how strong it will become, was designed that anybody who makes any request, petition, of any man or deity that is not King Daryavesh of Medo and Persia shall be immediately cast into the lion's den. Now, there's two implications. We'll see what the king agrees to. But there's two implications of this decree, or two questions we'll need to ask. One is, why is this the decree specifically? And we'll see it play out with Daniel in a moment, because what is included in this decree is a ban on prayer. Because what is prayer if not a supplication from a deity or god other than Dayavish? And so that's the piece that they're going to use to trap Daniel. But the bigger question that we need to address, and as we read through the parak, we'll look at it in more detail, is the logic of it. What's the logic from Dayavish's perspective? What's the logic of such a decree? And that's the question the Mefarshim struggle with. Ke'et ha-melech takim et Yisar, that the king established this edict, v'tirshom et ha-ktav, and sign it, shelo l'shanot, and let it not be changed. Kedat madayu paras asher lo ta'avor, in accordance with the laws of Mede and Persia, which cannot be altered. Sound familiar? Right? It's exactly, the language of Megillat Esther takes on a whole new life when you see it in the context of the other contemporary books of Persia and Babylon as well. But in this case, data shenichtav b'shem ha-melech v'nichtam b'tabat ha-melech en l'shanot, en l'havir, you can't remove, you can't cancel the decree of the king. That's exactly what they are saying here. Once it's established as a law, it cannot be removed, it cannot be canceled, it cannot be altered. And that was also part of the way of entrapping Daniel. There's a practicality to that law in a kingdom or an empire that spreads 127 provinces or 120 kingdoms, because it's impractical, if you will, to make a decree and then rescind it. It doesn't quite happen as simply as the mode of communication of the modern world. But there's also an ideology here that this is a kingdom in which the rule of law is paramount. Once something is set into law, kedat madayu paras, that rule of law is greater and stronger even than the authority of the king. The king can pass that law, but the king can't override that law. A fascinating cultural reference. And so the king, Dayavish, signed this law into being without, I think, realizing the consequences. The moment Daniel heard that this decree was signed, nichnas levito, goes to his house, v'chalonot p'tuchim lo ba'aliyato, with open windows in his attic, neged Yerushalayim, direction of Jerusalem, uzmanim shlosha bayom ukorea al birkav, 3 times a day he knelt on his knees, umitpalel umodel lifnei elokav, and to pray and give thanks before God, kolomat she'ya osem lifnei zeh, exactly as he had done before this. In other words, in short, Daniel could care less, right? Or couldn't care less. Daniel continues to go into his attic and daven 3 times a day, praise to God, praise towards Yerushalayim, exactly as he had done, as predicted by the advisors who set this in motion specifically for the purpose of catching Daniel in action. All right. I think we're going to stop here. And before we move, the next part of the parak deals with the consequences of this. I want to deal with a couple of questions up and on the parts that we've read so far. If I jump to the source page now for a moment, the Mefarshim just deal with the questions that we just asked. First question, the Malbim, Barbanel, they all essentially ask the same question. I apologize that some of these sources will have English later down below, but the Rishonim or the Mefarshim that I pulled, the Malbim and the Barbanel in particular, unfortunately I could not find a translation for, so I will read and translate as we go. But the logic of the decree, no prayer, no supplication, no request of any king or of any source, man or God, other than to the king. It's sort of an odd decree. And of course, from the perspective of the Achashtar Panim, it was designed to trap Daniel. The question, but you know, separate from that, there's got to be some logic to it, because the king so readily agrees. Dayavish, who does not strike us as a fool, he's not an Achashverosh who's depicted in Megillat Esther as a fool. He's a conqueror. He's a warrior. He's a king. He's a major power. Why does he kind of buy into this? What's the logic of this decree? And so the Mefarshim struggle with that question. The Malbim, who always starts question, follows sort of a pattern like the Abarbanel, starts with a series of questions and then he answers them. He says, Ech kibel me'em ha-melech dvar sichlut kazot. How could the king have accepted such folly? L'igzosh lo'it palel ish de'lo'av, that make a decree that nobody should daven, nobody should pray to his God. Atachat Elohimu, is he instead of God? Gam ha-melech ha-alim yitpalel, doesn't the king himself pray to God? Gam lama lo yivakshu az davar mi'adam, well, I can't ask, if I need sugar to make a cake, I can't go ask my neighbor for it, I gotta go run to the king for every request? That's absurd. Ech yitnu b'zeh tokef l'malchuto, how are they going to enforce it? Ish itza nivara mizu, is there anything more foolish than this? So his theory is the following. And again, working off the assumption that this decree is only for 30 days in length, right? That's exactly what they said, that this is for Shloshim Yom. Right? That's a... It's only for 30 days. It's like, it's this very small, limited in scope decree. So even that's complicated or questionable. Right? If you believe that you're making a decree because you want the king to be all powerful, then why limit it to 30 days? But the king's only all powerful for 30 days. After that, he's less all powerful. What is that? So here's the Abarbanel's suggestion. And the Malbim and the Abarbanel both give the same answer. Vishloshim yom harishonim. The assumption is that these are the first or early 30 days of the reign of the king. Shamelech bebavel. Bao elav shluchim mikol ha'amim b'amdinot. The king, Dayavish in this case, inundated by all kinds of representatives of foreign powers. V'yomushi skimu k'dei l'chazek malchuto b'enei kol ha'amim, in order to strengthen his position in the eyes of the nations, shebishloshim yom ela yavi kol ish bakashato al melech b'atzmo. In these 30 days, the king is at his strongest, and all the people will come to him and make the requests. Ben bakashot sheyesh l'adam me'adam. The king, in his magnanimity and in his benevolence, is willing and able to provide whatever people desire. Melech muchan l'malot bakashat kol shoel ki chafetz chesedu. As a show of kindness, as a show of magnanimity, the king is willing and able to yadora chava, his hands are wide and open, the malot bakashat, to fulfill every request. Even prayer and supplication, which a person would normally pray to God, they should bring to the king. Because ki yado ki yad alakim, because his hand is like the hand of God to fulfill every desire. Ubiyameh chesed ha'eleh, b'tchilat malchuto, in these days of kindness and compassion demonstrated in these early days of his reign, he will fulfill all the requests of the people without any need to seek out the requests of anybody else. But anybody who seeks such requests of any other source, he's almost committing treason because he's denying the benefit and the value and the contributions of the king and his chesed. That can be very dangerous. Such a person should be thrown into the lion's pit or the lion's den and put to death. In other words, says the Malbim, the basic foundation of the decree, the logic, is that the king is all powerful. The king is at his strongest when he first conquers the arena, he first conquers Bavel, enters Bavel, demonstrates his power over in his first 30 days by decreeing that anybody who has any kind of need, the king will be willing to grant that need to on any level. All one needs to do is ask, but only ask of the king. So says the Malbim. And that's the logic, and that's the interpretation of the Abarbanel as well. And that's the advantage of kind of helping us understand why it's limited to 30 days, and why the king kind of sees it in an instant light as part of a kind of a political move rather than as a direct move against Daniel. I would just make maybe one tweak in this suggestion, which is, whereas the Malbim's thought is that it's because because it is the first 30 days, Dayavish is strongest and they're therefore most capable of providing this kind of assistance and demonstrating his kindness. The other way to look at it is that in his first 30 days, the king is actually not strongest, but weakest. In other words, when a new regime, new conquest, new kingdom, what runs, you know, conquers a region, you always run the risk of rebellion, of those who don't accept the new regime, those who don't accept the kingdom, etc. So in those first 30 days, it's the most precarious. And the question is, who's loyal to the king and who's going to accept his authority and who's going to accept the new power and who's going to accept that they're no longer subjects of Babel. Now they're subjects of Persia. And maybe from that perspective, the same 30-day period would have been not a show of kindness and benevolence of the king, but rather a show of strength. You have a request, you have a desire, you want to show your loyalty, you show your loyalty to the king and to no one else, because there's a new king in town. It's not Belshazzar, it's not Bavel, it's now Dayavish, it's now Persia, Persia Mede. And that's the other way of looking at the question of Dayavish. Again, Dayavish Hamadi, we're 1 year before Koresh. This is the, that's the position of the Barbanel, the Malbim, and would make some sense in terms of the role of these satraps to come to Dayavish and make such a request. The other question is, why specifically prayer? Again, it's quite possible that the prayer request is directed not at individual prayer, but at institutions of prayer. Right? People gather together in institutions of prayer. The concept of the Beit Knesset that we have today comes from Bavel. It was an innovation in the Jewish world, specifically from Bavel. And so there are houses of worship or places of worship that people would gather. And if there's going to be an insurrection against the new king, that's likely where it's going to be seated. And so that may also play a role in this kind of request, which is out of character for Persia or Mede in general, but certainly not in the context of the story of Daniel. Okay, so let's go back to the text.
Why does Daniel do it to open windows?
Oh, that's the next question. We're going to get to that. That's the next piece of the story, which is Daniel's response to all of this. That is the next piece of the puzzle, and that we're going to have to look at both. I don't think we're going to finish that subject today. That's going to be our primary focus next week, is how to understand Daniel. Because what I've set up for now is, at least according to the classic Mefarshim, how to understand the mindset of Dayavish, who gets kind of roped into this decree without realizing its consequences. How to understand Daniel is a whole different issue, because Daniel does exactly that. Daniel defies the decree, and he does so in his attic with open windows toward Yerushalayim. 3 times a day, he comes and he prays, and he korea al-Birkav and mitpalel, and that's where the story picks up. All right, let's continue the parak, and then we'll come back. This verse, Yud Aleph, is going to be the centerpiece of our discussion, Daniel's tefillah, and what it that means for us. Azay ha'anashim ha'ela ragshu, then these people came, they made a noise, they were tumultuous. Umatsu et Daniel, they found Daniel. What did they find Daniel doing? Kneeling on his knees, praying toward Yerushalayim, seeking petition from his God. So they came to the king and they spoke, Alisa HaMelech, about the king's edict. Did you, king, not sign a decree? Any person who seeks any kind of request from God or man, or deity or man, for 30 days, other than to you, Yishlach L'Gover Arayot. Did you not sign such a decree? I did, in fact. Kedat Medayu Paras, Shelot Tavor. Such a decree is not to be altered. So they said, Daniel, this Daniel. Now look how they describe Daniel. Asher mi b'nei galut Yehuda. is a member of the exiles of Judah, the captives of Judah. He's the Jew from the exile. By the way, how many years has Daniel been in this particular part of the world? Right, Daivish is 62 years old.
Since he was a child.
Since he was a child. He's an old man at this point. And he described, and his loyalty has certainly been unquestioned. Daniel Asher Mibnei Galut Yuda. Lo sama lecha melech lev. He paid no attention to your decree. Ve'ala yisarash reshamta, nor cared about your edict. Uzmanim shlosha bayom mibakeshet bakashato. Not just once, but three times every day, he sought his petitions from God. Of course, the consequences are that he'd be thrown into the lion's den. Azayim melech kasher tadavar shama. When the king heard this, it was terrible to him. He was very upset by it. He was distraught by it. V'al Daniel sam dat latzilo. He wanted to save Daniel's life any way he could. V'ad mevo'e Hashem meshiyamit ametz latzilo. You know, you can imagine the story. He can just calls over his advisors. He calls over his judicial advisors. He says, okay, where's the loophole? What can we do to save this Daniel? Is there a loophole? Is there a context? Is there some sort of provision? Is there a notwithstanding clause? Something that we can used to save this man's life. And when the answer is no, as I anashim eilad agshu lamelech v'yamim lamelech, the people, these came and they demanded. And they said, da, no king, amelech, shadat lamadayu paras, this is a law of Mede and Persian. Shekol yisar v'kyum shamelech hakim en l'shanot, it can't be changed. And suddenly he runs afoul of his own government because he's trying to create an exception to a rule he set in place. And realizes that that is not doable. Azayim melech tziva v'viyu et Daniel v'hishlichu l'gova arayot. So they brought Daniel and they threw him into the lion's den. But before they did, Omer melech, Oneh melech v'mel et Daniel, the king offers a prayer to Daniel. And he says to Daniel, Elohecha asher ata oved oto tamid hu yatzilecha. May the God whom you serve save you. Uva even achat v'usmal piagov. So the big stone is brought and placed at the mouth of the den. Tama hamelech b'tabato, and locked or sealed with the king's ring, b'tabat sarav, shelo yishaneh davar b'Daniel, nothing be changed concerning Daniel. They didn't trust that the king wouldn't try to save his life. Azayim melech lehechalo, alach hamelech lehechalo, the king went back to his palace, v'lan b'tzom, and he went to sleep fasting. He didn't place any of the the versions it's translated here. And his slumber escaped him. He couldn't sleep at night. By the way, he's not the only Persian king in Tanakh that has trouble sleeping at night. Right? The parallel is really striking. The only difference is that Achashverosh couldn't sleep after he feasted, and Daivish couldn't sleep after he fasted. So, just an interesting contrast observation. King got up in the morning, and quickly, ran to the lion's den. Daniel, when he came close to Daniel, he cried out in a sad voice. Daniel, Eved El Chai, Daniel, servant of the living God. The God whom you constantly serve. Could he save you from these lions? Remember the story of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah in the furnace of Bavel, and Nebuchadnezzar comes to, is surprised in the morning, right? There it's a different context. Then Nebuchadnezzar was an enemy towards them. Daniel is their friend, and Daniel is Daniel's, very close to Daniel. Azai Daniel, Mamelech Tiber, and he says, Hamelech Lolamim Chiyai. Out of the lions, then comes Daniel's voice, and he says, may the king live forever.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Excuse me?
The Aramaic for lions is Ariyavata, which in the Yaribon is the word for the Torah. Is that a deliberate pun?
No. Oraita is a different word than Ariyavata. Ariyavata is the Aramaic for lion. Oraita is a different word.
I understand.
Karibon, in Karibon, we make reference to this story.
From Ariyavata, yeah.
Right. Yipum Ariyavata is from the mouth of the lion's den.
I get it. Thank you.
Okay. Amelech lalamim chiye. Elohai shalach malacho. God sent his malach, his angel. V'sagarat pi arayot. And closed the mouths of the lions. V'loch hibluni. They didn't bother me. They didn't hurt me. V'lamach lefanav zchut nimtzali. As long as I had some merit that he found in me, and know that I was loyal to you and did nothing to hurt you. As I am Melech, the king was thrilled that Daniel tzivalalot minagov, and they commanded Daniel to be brought out of the lion's den. They brought Daniel out, and he was unharmed, because he trusted in God. At that point, the king decreed, they brought the people who had accused Daniel, and he threw them into the lion's den, which, by the way, of course, is a repeat of what happened with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He threw them all in, the children, them, the children, their wives. And they didn't reach the ground before the lions pounced and they had their dinner, which had been denied them the night before. At that point, Dariavish writes a letter to all of the nations, and he said, under his kingdom, and he says, peace be with you. Milafanayu samtzav. I made a decree. Sher b'chol shelton malchuti yu zaim v'yireim milifnei Elohav shel Daniel. That in all of my kingdom, people should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Shuel chai v'kayam lo'olamim u'malchuto lo tishachet, which is, his kingdom is, his God is a living God, u'malchuto lo tishachet, and his kingdom shall not be destroyed. V'shil tono ad asof, he has dominion until eternity. He delivers and rescues. He does signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. Daniel miyat arayot, who saved Daniel from the hands of the lions. Daniel ze itzliach b'malchut Dariavash u'v'malchut Koresh ha-Parsi. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Dariavash and in the reign of his successor Koresh the Persian, whose story we have yet to read. That's the story. Now, there are some obvious points here, and there are some less obvious points here. I think the obvious points here are the parallels to Megillat Esther and the story of Ahasuerus, who is also of Persian, sort of same time period, if you will, although Begadol, there is differences between the different kings. But the other parallel, of course, is to the earlier stories of Nebuchadnezzar and Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and the effort of this moment of kind of a miraculous victory and moment when the decree of the king is thwarted by a nes from that God performs, to kind of win over not only the loyalty to Daniel and to his wisdom, but also a loyalty to the God of Daniel. And the same way Nebuchadnezzar writes a letter to his kingdom after it, after Hanani, Mishael, Azariah's story, and after to expound the virtues of the God of Israel, the God of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. You have a similar letter here written after the story of the lions with Dariavash. I would say that is probably the more the sort of the more obvious piece of this story. What's less obvious, I'm going to stop sharing for a second. What's less obvious, of course, is the role of Daniel in all of this. For example, we have a principle of Ein Sumchim al Anes. We don't rely on miracles. If Dayavish had made himself a public decree that anybody who is caught engaging in any kind of prayer activity or supplication activity or making efforts to establish a source of provisions other than the king, which is essentially what the decree is about. Right? It's not about borrowing sugar from a neighbor. It's about who is providing for the kingdom? Who is the source of provisions for the kingdom? Is it Dayavesh or is it the gods or is it the local governments who were there before? It's about loyalty. So from that perspective, Daniel is in a very precarious moment. It's almost analogous to Haman and Mordechai. Haman's decree, Achashverosh's decree that everybody should bow down to Haman, established Haman as a kind of an authority figure in the palace. And Mordechai is kind of standing there on the side and saying, you know what, I'm not going to bow down to Haman. But in that moment, he endangers his own life and he endangers the life of the rest of the Jewish people. Because Haman sets his sights on the eradication of the Jewish people, Asher Higid Lehem Asher Yehudi, because he's told that Haman is, that Mordechai is a Jew. And he's referred to as Mordechai Yehudi. Well, Daniel is also identified as Daniel Asher Mibnei Galut Yehuda, who's from the exiles of Judah. So Daniel is also so publicly identified as Daniel Yehudi. And what was he expecting to happen? Defiance of the decree of the king goes up to his attic, open windows, and engages in prayer three times a day? Does he not risk his life in such an action? Is he going to rely on the miracles of being saved by the lion's den, by Nace, in such a regard? Does he not endanger the status of the Jewish people in the Persian kingdom by doing so? Is this not a precursor to the Mordechai-Haman conflict that is, and Chazal is split over whether or not Mordechai was right or wrong in his defiance of Haman? So Gemara Megillah, Chazal is split over that question. Because it's not at all clear that Mordechai's behavior at that point was motivated correctly. And even if you tell me that Haman was some sort of a deity and it was idolatrous and you're not allowed to bow down to a deity, okay, so there are ways to avoid the circumstance. I'm not even sure that that's so, we can argue whether or not that's part of the story. But even if it was, there are ways to avoid the conflict. So when Haman goes marching by, you go, grab yourself a cup of coffee. And he has to stand there in the gates of the palace, Bishar Ha'ir, and stand in open defiance of Haman? And Daniel, is exactly the same question. In open defiance of the decree, he has to stand there with open windows and publicly praying three times a day to Yerushalayim? Of all kinds of prayers, that's kind of the most dangerous to in an atmosphere where they're trying to establish the sovereignty of this new king and the power of this new king and the authority of this new king. And who are you? What are you doing? You're publicly praying towards to the day that you can return to Yerushalayim. Dangerous to do so with open windows. Dangerous. And so the question the Mefarshim struggle with, and that's sort of the segue to part two of this discussion, the same question that we had about what's the logic of the decree in the first place, the same Mefarshim, Malbim, Barbanel, etc., raised the question, how could Daniel have so defied this decree? Interestingly, And this is the Malbim's. Oh, sorry, I forgot to do the forgot to hit the share screen. I jumped to it, but I forgot to share it. One second. Okay, this is the Malbim's phrase of the question. Lama masar Daniel et atzmo lemita b'shvil hatfila. Let's put it into halachic terms. Tfila is a major machloket Rishonim, Rambam and Ramban, whether or not tfila is a biblical requirement or a rabbinic requirement. Okay, we can argue. But in all cases, whether it's biblical or rabbinic, it's certainly not one of the big three. It's not a yarek val yavor. It's not idolatry. It's not adultery. And it's not murder. So on what basis does Daniel allow himself to be put in life-threatening danger because he wants to pray? The Torah says you should live by the commandments and not die by the commandments. These are the three cardinal sins for which a person has to be willing to give up his life, and this is not one of them. Not only that, listen, if you really want to pray, do it in such a way that nobody knows, nobody can tell. Do it silently, do it quietly, do it in secret. How many, in the worst circumstances of history, we managed to find ways to pray in secret. Daniel can't find a way to pray in secret. He has to open the windows of his attic and he has to do so in public defiance of the whole world. But Achman al-Libabai, Banishlam, at the end of the day, he understands our hearts. He understands our prayers. He understands what we think. So pray in your mind. You're talking about a period of 30 days with a public decree against tefillah. So live with it for 30 days. Save your life. That's the question. And it's a compelling question. I want to make it very clear. It's a very compelling question. And the answers that are offered are intense. We're going to look at those at that perspective. I just want to make one additional observation before we jump into them. And that is that this pasuk about prayer, Daniel, this is the Aramaic. When he knew that the decree was signed, he went to his house, opened his windows, or they had open windows, but the elite, in his upper chamber, in his attic, neged Yerushalayim, in direction of Yerushalayim, bezimnin tlata beyuma, and three times every day, barech al birkohi, he would kneel and on his knees and mitzale umode, and pray and give thanks before God, kadam aloha, kol kabil dehave avid min kadmatana, as he had done in days before. I read the Hebrew, this is the Aramaic. Why do I read the Aramaic now? Because I want you to see the Gemara and Brachas. Gemara in Brachos uses this pasuk of Daniel as the source for many of our customs of prayer. We are totally dependent upon this moment in Daniel's life. Says Rabbi Chiya, "Le'olam yitpalel adam b'vayit sheyesh chalonot." A person should always pray, if at all possible, a person should pray in a place where there are windows. A shul should have windows. Shene'emah, as it says by Daniel, that he had open windows. You might think that a person can pray all day long, every day, that prayer is just a constant state of conversation. You know, I kind of always reminds me of the kind of moments of Tevye, the milkman kind of walking through, talking to God in his, you know, various moments of the day. Says the Gemara Kfar Mufurash, Daniel Zimnin Tlata, Daniel already established a precedent three times a day. Maybe that was something which he started only when he came to the exile. So it says, this was something he had always done, three times a day. And here's the clincher. Maybe you should be able to daven in whatever direction you want. Why is direction important? No, Talmud Lomar, Neged Yerushalayim, direction of Yerushalayim. We pray in the direction of Yerushalayim. Why? Because Daniel set the precedent to pray towards Yerushalayim. We pray three times a day. Why? Because Daniel set a precedent for praying three times a day. Every time we get up to daven, Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, both in place and in direction and in time, we owe our a great deal to that moment of Daniel's tefillah. Fundamental halachas of tefillah are learned from this moment. And yet the Malbim says it was a moment born in defiance that seems so unnecessary. Because it was a time when you weren't allowed to pray and public prayer was banned. Okay, so public prayer is banned. So what is burning, Daniel, at this moment that you need to go into public defiance mode against the king you owe so much to? Daniel, you were put in place, you were put into a leadership role by Dayavish. You owe Dayavish. He's a partner with you. He supports you. Out of deference to Dayavish, you can't take a moment's pause and be respectful of the law of the kingdom? That's the question the Malbim asks. Okay? So that's the question we're going to have to pick up with from next week. And we're going to devote next week's shiur to exactly this question. What is it about prayer specifically, and Daniel's prayer in particular, that makes this such a crucial moment in the story? So I will stop here and open it up to a few minutes of questions if people have.
Except for the great theatrics of the lion's den, why does Dayavish not immediately kill the advisors? If he's rooting for Daniel so much, why does he have to wait to see if Daniel lives to kill the advisors and the wives and everybody else? If he wants to cancel it, he can cancel it. And who's to say that they cancel it even after Daniel lived? Why were they chayav misa then? What is the connection?
Because after Daniel had been saved, like the decree was, if you get caught in violation of this decree, you get thrown into the lion's den. So that was fulfilled. He threw him into the lion's den. Okay, they fulfilled the letter of the law. Now his life was saved. Now, okay, that's now in the past. Now the Yavesh is free to act as he chooses. But until that point, he's limited by the decree that he had been maneuvered into signing.
And presumably he canceled the decree.
We don't know that he canceled the decree. It's not listed. It's just a 30-day decree. What happens after that? I mean, presumably, in some way, I guess, maybe it was the end of the 30 days. We don't know. That part of the story is not recorded.
Thank you very much.
Surely Aryabhata and Oraita is a deliberate pun of the author of the story.
I am not convinced. They're different words in Aramaic and they have different roots.
Wordplay doesn't need roots sharing. It needs the words sound similar.
I will respectfully differ in this particular case. I don't think that's the issue, but if that's the direction you want to explore it, that's fine. I'm just not convinced that in this particular case that is. I also have to research how far back the word Oraita, in terms of Aramaic, is used for Torah. I'm not sure that it works in biblical Aramaic. I don't have an answer to that question.
Rabbi Shlomo, I find that from the same root as Torah.
Aryeh and is a lion. Ayavata is a lion in Aramaic.
I'm talking about. People think of Oraita as being related to Or, but not necessarily.
No, Oraita is the Aramaic for Torah.
Yeah, I know that.
You see it very clearly.
Hear Or within that, but I think it's probably from the same.
It comes from the root Torah, we're getting off topic. But
The stance of the Abarbanel is interesting in light of his position in history and having to run from the expulsion and the Inquisition and his stance on that. He ran away as opposed to converting even pro forma and trying to...
Right. So that was the Malbim, actually, who made the comment about running away. But yes, there's a lot of history. Look, we tend to read our own circumstances in history. It's very difficult in any commentary to divorce their own personal experiences, whether they be religious experiences or political experiences, from their interpretation of Tanakh or from their interpretation of anything, right? History. It's just, it's hard to be in that regard, anything of any really objective. It's like Nachman Leibowitz, Zichron HaLevracha, used to always say, translation is by definition a commentary. You can't translate without commentary. And commentary is born of our own experiences. You can't divorce a person's personal experiences from their commentary at all. So the effort to do so, I think, is somewhat futile. We're going to interpret this text, and we're going to infuse the interpretation with our own personal experiences and commentary, because that's who we are. That's what makes learning so alive. And so I'm not overly bothered by the or concerned about the fact that, you know, one commentary is born out of the particular political circumstances from where they were coming. Maybe. But that doesn't make it any less an effort to understand the text. And what we are therefore left with is, okay, this is their interpretation. Do we accept it? Do we buy it? Do we think that's pshat? Or do we want to offer an alternative? And in this particular case, we're going to see the Malbim. We'll see the Abarbanel in terms of how they deal with the issue of prayer. We'll judge that essentially as objectively as we can. And then we'll possibly offer a third approach, in terms of, as we did with the issue of the calculations, to try to understand what Daniel is trying to achieve.
Rabbi Shulman, I find very, very obvious parallels between Daniel's behavior and some people's behavior during the beginning of COVID. There was a life-threatening disease, and some communities, the rabbi said, we cannot meet in minyanim, we can't meet in shul to daven. I know my husband would have said Kaddish for his mother, and it was very, all right, he studied Mishnayot, he looked for something else, but it was, for a few months, it was very...
very difficult.
Very right. Difficult for him, but there were other communities, his brothers, I think that was part of Daniel. Some people do not change their...
Maybe. Some people do not change their behavior.
They're locked in.
That's a possible way to go. And we'll look at that. There is there's a fascinating discussion. We'll look at it next week. There's a fascinating discussion between two opinions in the Gemara. And there's a Sefer Hasidim, mm-hmm. whether or not prayer is in fact one of the big three for which you have to mm-hmm. give up your life for. Mm-hmm. Right, we assume that it's not.
There were many people from Haredi communities,
and there is an opinion that, with a high death rate there. But okay, so right. We'll deal with the prayer piece of it next week. Mizrat Hashem. All right, we'll stop here. Thank you for your comments in the chat. I will try to save it and then take a look at it, and then Mizrat Hashem next week. I always try to get on a few minutes early, so if anybody wants to kind of discuss, they're welcome to join us and do so. Okay. I don't know if Shira is on the call. I'm going to save the chat. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.